Okay, this is January the 22nd, 1990, and this is an interview with Georg von Tiesenhausen in Huntsville, Alabama. I'm just trying to see whether I have enough, seemingly. My microphone doesn't seem to be very loud. Let me try to. Can you speak just as a test?
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
Testing.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I think. Okay, let me just start now. I didn't seem to be having it, didn't get enough volume on this. Okay, can you state your full name, your birth date, your place of birth, and...
My name is Georg von Tiesenhausen. Mm-hmm. I'm born on May the 18th, 1914, in Riga, Latvia. Mm-hmm. I was raised in Germany, mm-hmm. near Hamburg.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Riga?
We had to flee 1918, mm-hmm. when the revolution started there. Mm-hmm. And thus came to Germany, where we had relatives. Mm-hmm.
Your parents and you have a noble title, or
yeah.
noble name, right?
Our family goes back to 1198. We colonized Eastern Europe to a large extent, especially Latvia, and played a great role there in the history of that country. We got the title of nobility about 1700 around mm-hmm. there. In Germany, we went to Hamburg, near Hamburg, mm-hmm. where I went to school and where I stayed through my whole adolescent years, mm-hmm. and I finished high school, mm-hmm. and went to engineering college, studying mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm. As far as your background is concerned, your family held the title of Freiherr, or
yeah, mm-hmm. Baron of Freiherr, which is mm-hmm. equivalent. Mm-hmm.
And your father, what did he do in Latvia, and what did he do after you had to flee?
He became a forest ranger in mm-hmm. Germany. Mm-hmm. And my mother worked mm-hmm. at the American consulate in Hamburg as a secretary to the consul. Mm-hmm. My mother was born in Scotland. Mm. And so I was raised bilingual, actually, mm-hmm. four languages. Where I was born, we talked English, German, Latvian, and Russian. And at the age of 4, I knew exactly to whom to talk which language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an ability that is a lot of people envy. It's only in Eastern Europe where there's so many languages that
yes.
you see often, so many multilingual
yeah.
people.
My studies were interrupted by an active period at the German Wehrmacht mm-hmm. between 1936 and 1938. Mm-hmm. And I continued studies until the outbreak of the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went to a gymnasium?
Realschule,
Oberrealschule.
Oberrealschule.
Mm-hmm, which is more technically
yeah.
scientifically
yes,
oriented.
Right. My enthusiasm for rockets started at the age of 14. Mm-hmm. I saw the famous movie Girl in the Moon, Frau im Mond, mm-hmm. which many of my colleagues saw too.
Right.
I saw it about 20 times until I almost knew each frame by heart. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I decided that's what I want to do. mm-hmm. during the rest of my life.
So that would have been, I know the movie premiered on October 1929.
Yes.
So you saw it as soon as it came out?
Out. I saw it about 20 times.
Yeah. So that would be at the end of 1929 and into 1930.
Yeah. So it was about 15 or so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The movie was directed by Fritz Lang. It was an UFA movie. And a woman was a writer, Thea von Harbou.
Yeah.
Was a writer. I know everything. Fritz Lang came to Huntsville in the 50s and played his silent movie for us again.
Yeah. I saw it actually, an American version of it. A version was remade recently with English subtitles and with a music with a sort of piano music soundtrack.
Yeah,
I think I've seen a tape of that.
It made it tremendous impression on me, and that turned me to spaceflight. I was drafted to the war and to the Air Force. Mm-hmm. The war started. Went through various countries of Europe and ended up at the Russian front finally. Mm-hmm. And 1941, Hitler called back all the engineers because he seemed to have realized he couldn't win the war with available technology. Mm-hmm. So out of the Russian front, out of the deepest mess, I was called back. Mm-hmm. I could finish my studies in Hamburg.
Okay, let me backtrack a little here. There's a lot of detail I want to fill in. You graduated from Oberrealschule, it would have probably been...
33.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you went to engineering school immediately, and where did you go?
No, I worked for a company, an iron works, Bergedorfer Iron Works. Mm-hmm. Financially, I had a big problem.
Yeah.
And studying and so on. And started my... And then I was drafted. Everybody had to serve 2 years in the Army.
So had you gone to university between...
No, not yet.
You were drafted in 36?
36 to 38.
Uh-huh.
And 38, I finally could go to my engineering college. Mm-hmm. To 39.
And where did you go?
Hamburg.
Uh-huh. So so you didn't go to a Technische Hochschule then?
No, I did not, no.
Did the University of Hamburg have engineering?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I was drafted, and like I said, I was called back in 41 to finish my studies. 41, 42, 43, I graduated 43 as mechanical engineering. And then I was examined in Berlin, Adlershof. The Air Force had a major institute there. Mm-hmm. They checked me out, and my papers received a big stamp, Peenemünde, where I had no idea what it meant. So when I arrived at Peenemünde, my wildest dreams had come true.
So you were not aware at all. You hadn't even heard rumors about rocket development.
No. It's very secret.
And in mechanical engineering, what did you specialize in when you were in mechanical engineering school? Did you have any particular direction?
You may not believe it. Mm-hmm. I graduated the construction of a major steam engine. Mm-hmm. So I was raised in the age of the steam engine. Mm-hmm. Quite awake from there to rockets.
Yeah.
But you see, the German engineering education is very thorough, very thorough. Mm-hmm. So arriving at Peenemünde, I immediately was tied in into ongoing projects without many questions asked. Mm-hmm. And the area there was test stands, rocket and engine test stands. You noticed my papers concentrate on that aspect.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me get some information. You came in what month of 1943?
April.
So you were assigned in April 43.
Yeah, April. I graduated in March 43. Mm-hmm. It was my first job. Werner von Braun was my first big boss.
Mm-hmm. So when you came, you went up there in April 43, not knowing exactly what you were going to. Right? And yeah. Your first impression was what?
My first impression was a feeling of awe.
Mm-hmm.
My dreams of rockets into space. At that time, the V-2 was for me an awfully big rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And the launches were awesome. And so I was there head over heels in a number of projects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that time, Peenemünde had about approximately 10,000 people or so. And Werner von Braun, I met him soon after I came. He greeted all the people who came newcomers. And we found out that we are related, at great distance related. Cousins, and so on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, our families are related.
That through sort of the family relationships of the aristocracy,
yes,
in Eastern Europe.
Right.
Huh?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
I know that he was
in Schlesien. Yeah.
Yeah. The family goes back to Schlesien, but he grew up in Pommern. And,
yes.
And,
right.
In Posen.
Yeah. They all know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So. The working conditions were very hard, 12 hours a day, Saturdays half a day. I was a soldier. You see, I was called back from the Russian front.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Unteroffizier, sergeant, so whatever.
You were a NCO, non-commissioned officer? You were
Unteroffizier, yeah. Yeah, non-commissioned, you can call it, yeah.
Non-commissioned.
So,
mm-hmm,
in Peenemünde, I had a choice between my military salary and my civilian, and the civilian salary.
Mm-hmm.
I took the civilian because it was more.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to wear uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Were you in the Versuchskommando Nord, or in this?
No.
Air Force unit, the Flakversuchsstelle.
Yeah, Flakversuchsstelle, yeah. Versuchskommando North was the army.
Right. Okay, now, I keep waylaying you to get more information, but you were in the Luftwaffe on the Eastern Front, mostly,
yeah,
right? And what position did you held? What was your role?
I was member of a single corps.
Mm-hmm.
We built communications between the tanks,
mm-hmm,
which were furthest advanced weapons, and the dive bomber squad,
right,
who were further back.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as the tanks got stuck, they wanted to call in the dive bombers,
mm-hmm,
to clear the area.
Mm-hmm.
And my unit was to establish and maintain that communication.
Mm-hmm. So I have a friend who's working on the history of the Luftwaffe on the Eastern Front. I'd be very interested in that.
And I was a member of the Air Corps 8,
mm-hmm,
Richthofen. It was named after the son of
Richthofen.
Richthofen,
yeah.
After
Richthofen,
the son of the Red Baron.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Richthofen.
That was Luftflotte.
Luftkorps, Luftwaffe Korps, Fliegerkorps 8.
Fliegerkorps 8, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that was only till late in 1941 when you came back?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
And that's, so you came back to Hamburg.
So my job saved my life, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, so you came back in 1941.
Yeah.
You were sort of put in a kind of duty where you did not, you still were officially part of the Luftwaffe, yeah,
but
you
studied
as a student.
Yes.
You
right.
were a student. Huh?
Yeah, I was allowed to complete my studies.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to wear uniform or anything in those that period
no.
of time?
No,
you
I
were
didn't.
Sort of.
No, I had civilian clothes.
Temporarily released.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you were assigned to Flakversuchstelle.
Yeah.
Karlshagen.
Yeah. It had all kinds of names over mm-hmm. the period. Elektromechanische Werke.
Yeah, which was
Flakversuchstelle. I don't know what else.
Yeah, Elektromechanische Werke was when Peenemünde was converted into a corporation.
Yeah, right, at the
in
end.
1944.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But the Flakversuchstelle is something that I need to know more about. So you were assigned to this unit.
Yes. Now, mm-hmm. I was not separated from the mm-hmm. A4 people
mm-hmm.
because I was in the area of test facilities and launch facilities,
mm-hmm.
and those were combined. I worked in both areas, B2, A4, mm-hmm. and Wasserfall,
mm-hmm.
depending on the need. And so I was located in House 4, famous House 4.
Mm-hmm.
Where
House 4. Yeah.
Yeah, House 4, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where Werner von Braun also.
That was the sort of headquarters.
Headquarters,
building.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, my wife worked also there.
Mm-hmm.
Between my exam as an engineer, the written and oral mm-hmm. exam, I married.
Mm-hmm.
Took a nerve, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you meet her at Peenemünde?
No,
or
in Hamburg.
In Hamburg,
Hamburg, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I married in Hamburg. And when I was delegated to Peenemünde, I wanted to have her with me.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to do that was to get her a job there. So she worked at the wind tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
She got a job at the wind tunnel and under Dr. Herrmann and others. So we survived the air raid, which in itself is a big story. Barely survived it. And we were transferred then after the attack to Marz Rohrbach. That is
how do you spell that?
M A R Z hyphen R O H R B A C H. That is at the Austrian-Hungarian border.
Mm-hmm.
There, I had the job to recreate the Wasserfall test stand
mm-hmm.
for memory, because all the drawings were destroyed.
Okay. Now, let me, before you go on, just for information, you were transferred to Austria. It was in Austria, was it?
Yeah.
And you stayed there for the rest of the war?
No.
Just for a short time?
About 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Now I want to first reconstruct this the Flakversuchstelle and how it worked. And you came reported, I assume, when you got there to somebody in who would command the Flakversuchstelle, and they immediately started assign. Did they assign you to a job, or did they just suggest?
My immediate boss was. Bernard Tessmann,
mm-hmm.
and Karl Heinburg,
mm-hmm.
who also had the test stands. So I worked for him. I had to design new test stands.
Mm-hmm.
Tessmann and Heinburg were my...
Okay.
contact.
Now, as far as this thing is concerned, because one of the things that I want to work out is the issue of Luftwaffe Army cooperation, in how close it was and whether there were any problems.
Okay.
So you were immediately assigned to a job in test stands that was not necessarily Wasserfall. It could have been Wasserfall, it could be A4
yeah,
or anything
right.
else.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So
the same design office covered mm-hmm. both. Mm-hmm. In that area.
And the people who were assigned to the unit, the Flakversuchsstelle unit, they did not, or the Wasserfall design people, they did not congregate in any particular location. They were just mixed in with the organization.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. There's another aspect which was very interesting. The officers and enlisted men who worked as engineers had often a different rank order mm-hmm. as professionals than as military people. Mm-hmm. So outside the job, there was a lieutenant, a colonel, whoever, and the GI. During the job, the mm-hmm. GI may be the boss. Mm-hmm. Heimburg was one.
Yeah.
And under him, he had officers. And I must say, that worked splendidly. Mm-hmm. There was no problem.
So you didn't... I've heard other people tell me that sometimes they did run into problems.
Well, why?
But not in your office.
I had to go on a duty trip, for instance, once. Mm-hmm. And one of my people, he was allowed to travel first class, while I had to travel fourth class. Mm-hmm. You know, because he was an officer. You see. It didn't bother me. But some people may have been upset about it. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. If I recall it correctly, I haven't seen any problems in this whole setup. Mm-hmm. And it worked really, really well from my point of view.
Mm-hmm. Now, from this is maybe a little bit outside your immediate experience, but was there a concentrated location where a lot of Luftwaffe people were together? Was there a Wasserfall design office or
yeah, there was. There was. First, the people had different quarters. Mm-hmm. The army people had their barracks, which were bombed, by the way.
Yeah.
And so had the Air Force people, but at a different site.
You're in the
more to the west. Uh-huh. Peenemünde West.
So,
was Air Force.
Yeah, and did you first go there,
or no,
you were
no,
married already?
No, never got, never was there. Mm-hmm. And now we had a choice to have private quarters. Mm-hmm. Since I had my wife there, I moved out of the got permission to move out of the barracks, and rent a room.
Mm-hmm. So you did live in these barracks.
At the beginning, yes.
Just for a short time.
For a short time, fortunately, yeah.
And the barracks were on the Peenemünde West installation, not on Peenemünde Ost, right?
No, there were barracks in both.
Yeah,
both
but I mean the Flakversuchsstelle.
Yeah, West. Uh-huh. Yeah. Peenemünde West.
And at that time, there was a fence between...
No.
West and East?
No, not to my
Some people mentioned there being a fence at some point.
I don't remember that.
Blocking or west-east, but as far as you were concerned, you just passed back and forth between the Luftwaffe and Army sides of the installation as if there was no difference.
That's correct, yeah. I don't recall any communication problem. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we had to communicate with both very frequently mm-hmm. because, like I said, the design office covered both aspects of testing. Wasserfall mm-hmm. as well as A4. Mm-hmm.
And as far as the Luftwaffe's role is concerned, you didn't notice any friction at all between Luftwaffe and Army?
Not to my recollection. We were so busy. Mm-hmm. We were all so enthusiastic about the work we did. There may have been here and there some frictions, but not nothing mm-hmm. apparent.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, much credit goes to Werner von Braun. He was in his early 30s,
mm-hmm.
master over 10,000 people. And it was just out of this world how he managed this, very personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his spirit penetrated the whole installation team.
You first met him right after you got there?
Shortly after, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Your
first impression?
Of admiration. When he talked to you, that's all that mattered at the moment. He talked direct to you, and everything else was out. And nobody ever interrupted him, you know, when he talked to you or listened to you. He was a great listener. He always responded to questions, suggestions. He was always open. Never remote, somewhere up there. He was never remote. He was always there. So I think his spirit sort of penetrated the team.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why his team lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
Here, too.
Yeah.
A phenomenon. He was a phenomenon.
How can you elaborate further? I mean, in what ways did he win the loyalty of people? And Peenemünde particularly, and also how did that affect Luftwaffe Army relations?
A number of things.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes little things. He remembered names in a phenomenal way. He may not have seen you for a year or two, and said, "Hey, you know, talk. How's your wife?" And so,
mm-hmm.
yeah. He gave recognition immediately. He had a magnetic personality. I talked at the von Braun Forum here a few months ago about him. And I said, he and John F. Kennedy had a lot in common, personality-wise.
Mm-hmm.
He was capable of creating enthusiasm for things, by his own enthusiasm. And people had unlimited confidence in him
mm-hmm.
that we could accomplish the things that we set out to do. Unlimited confidence. And he was never disappointed. He was a great politician, which was very important in Nazi Germany. And later here, of course, also. He knew every congressman and senator by first name and had lunch and dinner with them.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great politician. He was a great engineer and scientist. You have heard about the famous Day of Wisdom in Peenemünde.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was his way of working.
Mm-hmm.
He immediately penetrated all the garbage and got down to the critical area in the discussion. Saw immediately and came up with solutions. He could coordinate a meeting of dozens of scientists and engineers with different opinions that in a relatively short time, one opinion emerged. Mm-hmm. He could summarize all that was said in such a way that everybody agreed. Yeah. No.
Mm-hmm.
That gift. So it became very quickly apparent to me that there was a superior person at the steering wheel of this
mm-hmm.
organization. It became very apparent when the end came, when we had to get out of Peenemünde. And you can read up about that in various sources, how we got away there with falsified papers and all that. Mm-hmm. And he played the political game so that, for instance, we worked until the last minute, early 45, and spring 45, as if we had all the time in the world to do things that had to be done for political reasons. We were under the threat of being eliminated by SS General
Kammler,
yeah. And so he rose to the occasion at that time. Oh, I forgot to mention, of course, basically, his superior management skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing to organize the exodus of thousands of employees with families within a few days. And my time at Peenemünde was filled out with essentially the following jobs. Working Prüfstand 7, Test Stand 7,
mm-hmm.
Expanding it, building from scratch Prüfstand 2, Test Stand 2, which was a Wasserfall engine test stand,
mm-hmm.
the one you had the sketch. And I never forget it. Rudi Reichel was mm-hmm. test director. And I designed the viewing slot
mm-hmm.
through the 3-foot concrete wall at standard heights. And it was cast in concrete. And he was 6'3". He never forgave me for that. But he did, but anyway. I designed Prüfstand 12.
Mm-hmm.
That is the submarine launcher. We had contracts in Stettin with shipyards to build them. They were never built. We had wooden models. All we did build was a test stand. I designed Project Swim Vest, that is Life Vest, a floating C2.
Mm-hmm. Floating Wasserfall.
Wasserfall test stand, mm-hmm. because the idea was to not be a target on land when bomb raids came.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to, I couldn't find my reference. I have the drawings of Swim Vest. I better. That and the other, I will send you copies. The last job I did was Prüfstand 12,
mm-hmm.
12. Which was 12 yeah. was super secret.
Mm-hmm.
Only 5 people worked on it. I was one of them. The late Dr. Hans Hüder was one.
That this was the submarine launch.
The submarine, yeah. Then Bernhard Tessmann.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the others at the moment. So we were separated from that design office into a different location to design this.
Mm-hmm.
So. We had also, we worked under colossal strain at Peenemünde. On the other hand, we also had good times. We were young people. This was my first job after college. Young and enthusiastic rockets. Mm-hmm. We thought about space flight. So we had good times. We had parties. Parties with rocket fuel.
Mm-hmm. You had alcohol.
Yeah.
Ethyl alcohol.
Yeah, of course, there are a lot of stories about that, that was ordered by the military to denature it. Mm-hmm. And of course, we put our chemist right on the job to get the stuff out of it again. You know, mm-hmm. with carbon filters and whatever. Mm-hmm. So we had also good times, as young people had. We were under a colossal strain, especially after the bomb raid. When we came back, we were evacuated first, and then we came back, at least the group I was with. There were some more. There was another air raid, not so big. And the food was lousy. Mm-hmm. I remember we had water soup with little tiny fish floating in it, like you're used to, what you call bait. And but somehow, looking back, I learned a tremendous amount of knowledge there about rockets and how to test them, what it was all about. Which has benefited me for the rest of my life. Because we had no precedent for anything we did. No handbooks, no magazines to look, no articles, papers. Nothing had a precedent. So we had to go by what we have learned. And I remember my first job as an engineer, a mechanism on Pulstan 7, I designed and had it built. How amazed I was. It worked. Hey, it works. I had to apply all the formulas and knowledge, you know, you learn in school, but never really practiced it. Mm-hmm. So that was the best engineering education I ever received.
What was the device you were working on? What was that first job? Do you remember?
Oh, it was the V2 was hanging in a test stand and had a ring around it.
You mean the wall that's around test stand 7?
No, it had a gyro ring around it, a very heavy ring.
Oh, I
ring.
See. Yeah. All right. So it was in a gimbal ring.
In a gimbal ring, yeah. And that I worked. Mm-hmm. So it could swivel.
Right, so that you'd test the...
The gimbal mechanism, yeah.
You would test the engine with the guidance running
so that you could see the
vein action and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Then we had a lot of challenges. The carbon veins, we are one. Graphite veins. Nobody had ever worked graphite with tools, big veins. And we had, it was very frustrating. With metal tools, it didn't work. So finally, somebody had the great idea, use woodworking tools. They worked. Another challenge was the C2 tanks had to be emptied in any position. Up or down. See, the C2 could be steered with a joystick.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it had all kinds of positions.
Maneuvering.
And the fuel always had to cover the exit hole. Mm-hmm. If it didn't, it was big trouble. How do you design a tank and an emptying system that the tank openings always covered with fuel? And there was a contest throughout Peniman for a design that did it. And a mechanic in the mechanical laboratory, he found the best solution. It's sort of a swivel arm that always points down by gravity and sucks up the fuel. So there were all kinds of challenges had to be solved. And like in the rocket business in general, there are no 2 days alike. So we learned really the trade there by trying, trial and error. We had hundreds of failures. We learned by trial and error. Rockets were started and launched right in the middle of the complex, Peniman. We looked out the window. So if you compare that with today's safety precautions, it's sort of amazing that nothing happens. One very great plus was, and we touched on that before, personal relationships of that team. We felt we are a team. And that's a very strange thing, to belong to a team. You know what the others are thinking and doing, and you have 100% trust in the other person. And you have to depend on other people. If they give you the wrong information, you're in trouble.
Let me ask you a question about that. You remember this, I mean, obviously this certainly existed here. Do you remember very distinctly that at Peenemünde there was already the sort of feeling of being a team?
Yeah.
Being on a distinct group. What word would you use for team? I wouldn't know what the German equivalent would be that would be appropriate.
I've never thought of that. That's a very good question.
I mean, what language would you use to just talk about that or think about that?
First, the word team is used in German too. Not just now, but used to be used, and team.
Even before 1945.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. The word team is pretty widespread. As an alternative to that, Gruppe. Gruppe, which doesn't mean exactly the same. But, Gruppe would be the best alternative. Yeah, the team spirit developed in Peenemünde and was continued here.
So you've very distinctly felt that you were a unique group.
Yeah.
That with a very high morale, very high esprit de corps.
And the interesting thing is, of course, we took that with us here. When I came here, I worked for the same boss. You know, the other people. It was as if I have left my office in Peenemünde yesterday. And today I came back. We had exactly the same organization here than we had in Peenemünde. The same structural organization through 1970.
Now, of course, in the meantime, you lost a number of people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people left.
But the
organization, Erica left.
Yeah, but the organizational structure was the same. The laboratories. And many of the lab directors. One thing we brought with us was our cooperation with universities. In Peenemünde, the main job, the fundamental job, was done by German universities. They are wisdom here. And many of the former university professors became lab directors, even here. Dr. Geisler, Stuhlinger, Hermann, and many others. They became lab directors and are still here. So we tried to continue this cooperation with universities here, but it didn't pan out too well.
Now we'll have to talk about that. I'm getting close to the end of the side of this tape, so I have to turn it over.
There's one aspect that we brought with us from Peenemünde. Peenemünde, we were isolated from the rest of the world. And we had to learn and know everything that was necessary. We brought that philosophy here. We were the most independent bunch you could imagine from Brown Team in Huntsville, which didn't go over too well, of course, mm-hmm. in a different environment. We were now in an open society, but we still kept together and told people, just give us the money and don't bother us. Mm-hmm. We will deliver. Of course, we couldn't afford to say that. We did deliver every time.
Mm-hmm.
But this very fierce independence stuck with us all the time. And don't tell us what to do. Just give us the money.
Let me stop the tape.
Yeah.